Well, tonight we come to roughly Genesis chapter 12, and it's interesting. If we go back to chapter 6 and 7, 8 and 9, right in there, we go to the flood, and as we review that story, I forgot to put the thing on so I can see my own slides when I did that. Through the flood, God wipes the slate clean. He literally purges the earth and gives Noah and particularly his sons the opportunity to walk faithfully before God. This is Earth, 2.0. He gives them an opportunity to just a fresh start. And one would think that wiping out planet Earth, all of the air-breathing, land-based creatures, except for those that were on the ark, would have been a wake-up call to the eight people that survived that and might, make a memory. You would think that it would be pretty well etched into your mind that we need to walk in obedience to what God tells us to do. And so it would seem. But by the time we get to chapter 9, Noah, like his ancient predecessor Adam, is having problems with fruit. He plants a vineyard, and he makes wine, and he gets drunk, and he lays naked inside his tent. And Ham, his firstborn, comes in and sees his father naked. And, he should have responded differently, should have responded with deference to his father. He should have responded in respect to his father to cover up his nakedness. But instead, he thinks it's funny. So he goes out and tells his brother, "Dad's drunk in the tent and he's buck naked." That's not what it says literally there, but that's the message that gets communicated. And then Shem and Japheth, the middle son and younger son, they take some clothing, an article of clothing, and hold it between them and walk in backwards and cover their father up. And, we have kind of no more, it seems, that we've gotten off of the boat, that we're already starting to have respect issues. We're having problems, and these are fairly minor, but they play a significant role in what comes later. Noah lives another 350 years. His sons go on then into chapter 9, or chapter 10, and their family genealogies are recorded there. In chapter 9, verse 1, it says that God blessed Noah and his sons, and he told them to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The idea here is to scatter out and populate the planet. That's the command. It's the same command, basically, he gives Adam and Eve. Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, subdue it. Those kinds of things. So that we just get Earth 2.0. Second chance to do it right. By Genesis 9, verse 18, we start having problems. I have the wrong reference up there, David. I put 10. I was working in 9 and 10 at the same time, and I got the whole thing wrong. Should it be chapter 9, verse 20. And then on into chapter 10, we see problems starting again. Now, 10 is, again, one of those genealogies that we love to skip because they're full of names of people we don't know, we basically don't care about, and so we'll tend to brush past them. But if you go to chapter 10 and verse 6, we get the descendants of Ham, the son who was cursed because he disrespected his father. And his descendants were Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. And the descendants of Cush were Seba, Havilah, Sabta, Ramah, and Septica. The descendants of Ramah were Sheba and Dedan. Cush was the father, was also the ancestor of Nimrod. Here's where the story gets interesting. Who was the first, the New Living translates this, heroic character, heroic warrior on earth. Warrior there is a key word in this translation. Since he was the greatest hunter in the world, his name became proverbial. People would say, this man is like Nimrod, the greatest hunter in the world. Nimrod built his kingdom in the land of Babylonia with the cities of Babylon, Erech, Akkad, and Calneh. And from there, he expanded his territory into Assyria. Assyria was territory that was given over to Shem. So here you have descendants of Ham conquering territory that was given to the godly line of Shem, building the cities of Nineveh, Rehoboth-ir, Calah, and Rezin, cities located between Nineveh and Calah. And so we have problems arising. Here was a man who, instead of dispersing and spreading out and multiplying and filling the earth, is building cities. And he is conquering. And he is, several of the scholars that I read believe that these cities that he was building were basically almost frontier stockade-type forts. They were outposts where you could hold territory, hold sway over territory from classically Middle Eastern strategies here. And so as we meet Nimrod in Genesis chapter 10, he's a problem. He's a problem. He's doing exactly the opposite of what God told him to do. And from 9:1, where he told him to be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth, Nimrod begins to build cities and conquer the earth. Group up and bent toward conquest or the oppression of other people. Mankind's propensity towards sin begins to be surfaced immediately after God confirms his covenant in chapter 9. We get the story of the rainbow, the whole nine yards. They're off the ark. Everything is good. God gives them a simple command. And before we get out of chapter 9, we're already messing it up. It doesn't take 1,000 years. It hardly takes one. And we are already messing with what he told us to do. And folks, when we look at it, the center post of the sin that is being described here is pride. And this is what keeps repeating in Nimrod's story. So that kind of sets the background. We come to chapter 11, and there's just a handful of verses here that deal with the story that we call the Tower of Babel. And Genesis 10, beginning or 11, beginning with verse 1. At one time, all the people of the earth spoke one language. They spoke the same language. They used the same words. As people migrated to the east, they found a plain in the land of Babylonia, and they settled there. They began saying to each other, "Let's make bricks and harden them with fire." In this region, bricks were used instead of stone, and tar was used for mortar. Then they said, "Come, let's build a great city for ourselves with a tower that reaches into the sky. This will make us famous and keep us from being scattered all over the world." But the Lord came down to look at the city and the tower the people were building. "Look," he said, "the people are united. They all speak the same language. After this, nothing they set out to do will be impossible for them. Come, let's go down and confuse the people with different languages then they won't be able to understand each other. In that way, the Lord scattered them all over the world. They stopped building the city. That is why the city was called Babel, because that is where the Lord confused the people with different languages. This is why he scattered them all over the world. Now, the world, the word Babel is a play on words, and it's composed of three Hebrew letters, and it has to do with the confusion of languages. So we have the background. The men, the people are moving east. If the ark presumably comes to rest in the mountains of Ararat in Turkey, as many scholars believe that it did, then to reoccupy the Fertile Crescent area, the land between the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers, they're going to move east in an easterly direction from modern-day Turkey back into the eastern reaches of the Middle East, Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, those places, what are today those places. And so they come to this plain, a nice flat plain, the plain of Shinar, and there they decide to build a walled city. They used baked mud bricks. A couple of weeks ago, when we took Catherine's mother up to bury her in Mexico, Missouri, if you've ever been through Mexico, Missouri, there is the A.P. Green brick company that was in Mexico, Missouri, and the A.P. Green home is huge, and we drove by the old brick plant, and they're tearing it down. Most of that brick plant is in shambles as they're dozing it down and reducing it down, and those beautiful old buildings, that were offices and things, are still there. But that's what they're doing. They're baking bricks. So the question is, why? Why were they doing that? Because in this area of the world, there's no stone. You're working on alluvial deposits there, just dirt, sand, whatever that is there. They don't have stone to build with, and archaeologists have confirmed this again and again and again. They're using a baked clay brick, and they're using tar for mortar, and they find this in the archaeological remains even today, these bricks with this tarry substance on them to hold them together. So they began to build the city, and in the city is going to be this tower. Okay? It's going to be a walled city. The tower that they build is most likely what is called a ziggurat. Not a cigarette, but a ziggurat. It's a stepped pyramid. Now, the tallest building in the world is, where is that these days? Is it Dubai still, or has China gone beyond that? There's several of them that are in process. You know, the Empire State Building was the tallest building in the world for like 30 years. And it was surpassed, I think, by the Sears Tower, maybe. And the Sears Tower was the tallest building in the world for about a year. And then it was surpassed. And then it's been trading hands. The Eiffel Tower was the tallest man-made structure in the world for quite a period of time, and so you had these long plateaus. Now the tallest, the world record holding tallest building will only be that until they get the next one finished. And I had a picture. I started to put it in the slides. It was a composite photograph. It was really nicely doctored of the tallest buildings in the world, five or six tallest buildings in the world, and it was just from the clouds up. The tops of these buildings are all above the clouds. And it's pretty impressive. God wasn't worried about them getting too close to him with a building. That wasn't the problem here, that somehow they were going to build a stepped pyramid that got too tall and threatened his domain. Let's just be clear going into this. This isn't the problem. What was the tower named? I'm sorry, what? Is that what the text said? because the text never named it. The city was Babel. The city was called, the tower's never named, folks. Those headings in your Bible, you got to watch them. Those are man-made, and they can mislead you. Every once in a while, they do something silly with that. That was just for fun. I don't mean to be. So go ahead and throw up the stepped pyramid, David. That's what a stepped pyramid looks like. And when you can't see it because it's too pixelated, but way down at the bottom of the steps, there's a little bit of a shadowy line there. That's a person. Way down at the bottom. This is a pretty good size structure, especially when you're talking about the period of time that this was being built. But you can tell simply from the architecture, there's only so high this can go. Because every layer is significantly smaller than the layer before it. And just geometry is going to limit how tall this thing can be. One of the tallest buildings, I forget which one it was, it might have even been the Empire State Building. It was the Empire State Building. Was not the tallest building for a while because they had taken an aerial down off the top of it. But they replaced it, and so it went back into the number one spot because of an antenna that was on top of the building. And so this structure was only going to get so far. And so it's important to understand that God's problem with their building this city and tower has nothing to do with the physical place that they're building. God's problem has nothing to do with the height of the tower. It has everything to do with man's pride and his desire to willfully disobey God and make himself God. What did they say here? We're going to build this city. What was their rationale? It was so that it will make us famous, and it will keep us from being scattered all over the world, keep us from doing what God has told us to do. Now, this gets real interesting to me because of its parallels to Genesis 3. There are just some interesting parallels between the story of Babel and what happens there in Genesis chapter 3. In Genesis chapter 3, God tells Adam and Eve, you know, you're free to eat of anything you want to. The garden is yours. You have one rule, don't eat from the fruit of the tree in the middle. Here's this one thing you're not supposed to do. In Genesis chapter 9, he tells them, here's what I want you to do, to disperse, to fill the earth and inhabit it, spread out, don't group up. And so immediately they are drawn to do the thing that God tells them not to do. The one thing God tells them not to do, they are immediately drawn to do. Another interesting thing is that Adam and Eve see that the fruit is suitable to make them wise. The serpent tells them that if they eat this, they will be like God, knowing good and evil. He entices them to take their eyes off of God and look to themselves for their own rules. When you look at this story in the first nine verses of Genesis chapter 11, you will see that as this story is being told, there are five personal pronouns in those nine verses. We will do this. We is twice. Us is twice. You know, they just keep referring to what they are going to do. They are taking their eyes off of God and putting their eyes on themselves as God so that they can determine for themselves what is right and what is wrong. Now, what I'd like to do is tell you that this story is really old and it doesn't happen anymore. Folks, we're not building a stepped pyramid in our backyard, but how much of our time as followers of Jesus Christ do we do our life with our eyes on ourselves trying to figure out by ourselves what is right and wrong for ourselves. This is so common. This is, it is so just innate. I'm not sure the word I'm looking for, to the human condition. This is our almost like default programming. We are so easily deceived in that direction. In both stories, God refers to himself in the plural. Let us go down and see what they're up to. God didn't have to come down to see what they were up to. God is using the plural form Elohim in both stories, referring to himself in plural. Scholars have different explanations for why that is. I think it's the Trinity talking to itself. It is a singular noun that is written in a plural form, a singular being referring to himself in plural form, and we get that in both stories. God comes down into the midst of the sin, and then he kicks them both out. Adam and Eve, he just says, "You're heading out the eastern gate. Get going." With these guys, he confuses their language so that they, literally the word there is their lips. He confuses their lips so they can't communicate, and they abandon the project. They walk away because nothing makes sense anymore. So many, and I'm sure there are more. Those are the ones I just grabbed off of the surface here, folks. It is amazing the parallels between these verses in chapter 11 and the handful of verses that we see again in Genesis chapter 3. As we consider this, I just want, when will we learn? You know, where have all the flowers gone? You remember the song, the protest? It was a pretty mild protest song from the 60s. You know, where have all the flowers gone? Young girls pick them, everyone. Where have all the young girls gone? You know, gone, they've married young men, you know. Where have all the young men gone? Gone to soldiers, everyone. Where have all the soldiers gone? Gone to graveyards, everyone. Where have all the graveyards gone? Gone to flowers. You know, it's just that cycle. And it makes me feel this way when I read these stories where we keep doing the same things over and over again. You go just a little, you know, into the book of Exodus, and you have God reaching down into his people to do incredible, miraculous things. And all he says is, just do what I tell you. Just obey my commandments, and everything will be fine. Your days in the land will be long. You won't suffer any of the plagues of Egypt. You know, just do what I'm asking you to do here. And they can't get, you know, 3 days out into the wilderness, and they're groaning and belly aching and questioning the God that just brought these 10 incredible plagues that demonstrate his superiority over all the gods of Egypt. And they're already grumbling. They walk through the Red Sea. They walk through the Red Sea, and they get 3 days on the other side, and they're grumbling. That we come out here to die in the thirst in the wilderness. There's no water to drink. They get water to drink, and now we're going to starve to death. And he gives them manna and quail. Just read about manna. If you come on Wednesday nights and you look at the terrain that they're in and you think about picking manna up off of that mess, it's kind of, you know, it's not like they walk out here in these beautiful little mowed grass pastures. And there's this flaky substance on the top of it. They're scraping it off the rocks because there is no little grassy pasture in this place. It is uninhabitable land. And he gives them that every day. And it says it doesn't matter if they pick up a little bit or a lot. They all had enough. And 6 days a week, you picked up what you needed, and God made it work. And then on the sixth day, you picked up enough for 2 days. And if you did that during the week, it would rot and stink. and get wormy, but if you did it over Shabbat, it didn't. It worked every day for 40 years. And how many times did they grumble? How many times? We get to Kadesh Barnea 3 months in, and all they've got to do is head north. And they won't go. Somehow the guy that's done all of this other stuff 3 months ago can't handle the conquest of Canaan. And folks, it goes on and on and on. When will we ever learn? God's job is now and will always be above our pay grade. We don't have the necessary tools to be God. Folks, I am convinced that when we get to heaven and we get those glorified bodies that aren't going to get fat, and I'm going to have a full head of hair, and it's going to be thick, maybe curly. I don't know. I haven't decided on that yet, but, you know, I'm going to have hair, and we'll be able to eat and enjoy it and not have problems. My back's not going to hurt. My knees aren't going to be bad. I'm not going to get that electricity shooting up my hand when I try to open a jar of pickles. You know, none of those things are going to be there. But even in that body that's never going to grow old, it's never going to diminish, it's never going to fail, even in that body, I am only going to understand a tiny, tiny fraction of the God who spoke me into being. And yet, somewhere along the line, we've decided that Satan's persistent lie that we have the right to be God for ourselves, to determine what is right or wrong for ourselves, and that we have somehow the wisdom to pull that off. In this story, again, as we keep going through Scripture, we keep hearing the same theme repeated. I'm God and you're not. There was a bumper sticker that was out a decade or two ago, and it said, there are two great truths in our world today. There is a God, and you're not Him. Thank goodness. You guys should thank God every day that I'm not God, because I would not be gracious. I would not be. I'd make the Greek gods look like saints. But we don't have the perspective. We don't have the wisdom. We don't have the love. We don't have the compassion, the mercy, the grace to do what it takes to interact with other human beings. We'd be zapping people right and left. And yet we think we can. We think that we can determine right and wrong. And not only can we determine it, folks, we can legislate it. If we just get the right people elected and keep the wrong people from being elected, we will have perfect law. Really? Really? I'm pretty sure we had some pretty good ones way back there in the past with the George Washingtons and some of those guys that were pretty smart, pretty God-fearing people. And they still didn't have perfect government, because government is filled with people and we're not perfect. Folks, we don't have to build a tower to get to God. He only had to build a tree to bring us home. He didn't have to erect some great tall building that pierces the clouds. He only had to grow a tree. And out of that tree, the Romans fashioned a cross. And on that cross, they hung the Son of God, who paid your sin for your sin and my sin, and He built a bridge that allows us to gain access to our Heavenly Father. wasn't fancy. It wasn't smooth and slick and finished. I think most of us had even stopped to look at it if we saw it laying on the ground. But it accomplished his eternal purposes. But Satan constantly pushes us to defy God's plan when it's God's plan alone that saves us. Wherever did Satan push humanity to do something that was good for us, that just really worked out? I'm not finding it, because that's not his agenda. He is the one who has come to steal, kill, and destroy. That's his agenda. Why do we listen to that voice? Why are we constantly defying what God's plan looks like in order to set ourselves up as God so that we can just rain havoc down on our own lives and the lives of those around us? God has given us case study after case study here to show us that we're not smart enough to make this work. We need him. And we need to be not only content with that, but daily willing to embrace it. So two questions for you tonight as we wrap it up a little bit early. I'm going to give you some of it back, Zach. Where are you and I self-consumed? Where are we being self-focused? Well, I've got to get these finances straightened out. I've got to get this debt paid off. I need to, you know, work on this. I need to get these kids in line. I need to fix this problem. I need to... How many times do we find ourselves using those personal pronouns in our thought processes as we go about our day-to-day life, folks? That ought to just be a huge warning flag for us. A huge warning flag that I am looking to myself to sort out my own problems. That is self-focus. I say that in Genesis 3, there was an illness that took place. It was a vision problem, and I call it myopia. They became myopic, and all they could see was what they wanted and what they felt God was withholding from them. And every time Satan, I don't know how he works with you, but every time he pushes me off course, it is when I'm looking, when I become consumed with my problems, my wants, my plans. And I cease to look at him. Where are we trying to do this on our own and failing to rely on God? God's plan is really basically simple. Trust and obey. That's what the old hymn said. No other way is we just need to trust him. The God that had eternity before creation to figure this stuff out has not been caught off guard by your problems. He is not ill-equipped. He's not in some sort of emergency staff meeting with the archangels trying to sort out how he's going to take care of your issues. He wrote the story from the end to the beginning, the scriptures tell us. He knows what's going on, and he's going to give you time to process through it, but we need to be leaning on him and not our own wisdom. And that, folks, is the story of the city of Babel. It was left in shambles. It was a tower. And I think Jesus speaks to that. What man decides to build a tower and doesn't count the cost, and it's left in shambles, and everyone laughs. Folks, that's what it came to represent, was the unfinished, the unthought through work of humanity. And we leave those all over in our lives. Tonight, folks, let us recommit ourselves to avoid this error and to look to God for His wisdom and His understanding, folks. And we find that most clearly recorded in His book.